Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we sift through the sources you share and pull out those essential nuggets of knowledge. And right now, I think a lot of us are in this kind of collective state of mental hibernation.
Yeah.
It's early February. The thrill of the past season, whether that was, you know, big game hunting or even football, it's completely faded.
You're describing that postseason slump perfectly, that dread. It's cold, the holidays are long gone, and you just find yourself staring out the window with a really bad case of cabin fever.
Yeah.
But the good news is this exact time, this window, is actually perfect for a very focused outdoor activity, one that can directly help you out for the rest of the year.
Exactly. And that's what we're talking about today. Shed hunting, the search for naturally cast deer antlers. We're doing a deep dive into the tactics, the timing. And what really surprised me in the material is kind of profound philosophical shift that really separates the novice from the, you know, the expert.
And the timing is so, so critical right now. Based on everything we looked at, all the biological factors, by the first or second week of February, it's a pretty safe bet.
A safe bet that what?
That basically all the mature bucks have dropped their antlers. The hormone shifts have happened. They're out there ready to be found.
So this isn't just a leisurely walk. I mean, for most people doing this, it's a very strategic thing, right?
Yeah.
What's the actual goal?
The motivation, it runs really deep, and it's 100% tactical. Finding a shed antler from a big mature buck is like recovering a piece of intel.
Yeah.
It's often your only chance to physically get your hands on, you know, the horn from the biggest deer that got away from you during the season. The one that got away.
Ah, okay. So the second you find that big shed, you know exactly where that deer was living postseason. And that helps you build a whole plan for next fall. It makes scouting real.
Concrete. Precisely.
Yeah.
Sure, it's part trophy recovery, but it is mostly about gathering knowledge.
Thirsty.
You're confirming the deer's health, the size of his rack, and this is crucial, the general area he's using for winter cover and for food.
Okay, let's unpack this then, because we have this fantastic source that details all the specific tactics, but the author kicks it off with an admission that just screams irony. Despite knowing every trick in the book, they admit to being, and I'm quoting here, wildly unsuccessful.
Yeah.
A lifetime of trying, and they only found a grand total of two sheds. I mean, that's a fascinating place to start. It just immediately shows you the difference between the theory and the very tough reality.
It says so much about how difficult this really is. You can read the perfect how-to guide. You can practice the slow scan technique, and still, you come up empty.
Right.
I mean, think about it. These are small objects. They're often the exact same color as all the dead leaves and junk on the forest floor. The fact that the author, who's an experienced hunter, had such a low success rate, that should really calibrate your expectations from the get-go.
And the two finds they did have, they really highlight just how random it can be, don't they? They're almost comical.
They absolutely drive home that it can just be pure chance. The first find was this tiny little four-point side, and the author said it was actually stuck in a tree.
In a tree?
Yeah, practically at eye level. If they hadn't turned their head at that exact split second, they would have walked right by it. It was found because it was in the wrong place.
Wow. Okay, and the second one?
The second was much better. A nice five-point side, just lying in the middle of a wide-open cornfield.
In the open?
Yep. Just five steps from where the author had stopped to take a break, it was just found because they happened to stop moving at the exact right spot. Neither one was the result of some, you know, perfectly executed tactical search. It was pure serendipity.
The universe just handed them those two sheds, not the instruction manual.
Okay, but if we get past that frustration, the material does lay out the fundamental logic, the basic rights and wrongs that give you a better starting point. Right. If you want to move beyond just pure look, you have to start thinking about the animal's survival needs in the dead of winter.
Okay.
Deer need two things right now. Food, and lots of it. And dense, secure cover. If you can find where they're eating and where they're sleeping, you're putting yourself in the right zip code.
So we're not just wandering aimlessly through the woods. It's about finding those resources. What are the best examples of those in, say, February?
Food sources are absolutely key. You have to think about what's even available after heavy snow. So that usually means food plots that might have some standing grain left, maybe some specific types of cut corn fields, or, and this is a big one, thick browse lines.
Right.
They're not wasting energy searching. They're conserving it.
Yeah.
So if you find that food, the bedding area is almost always very close by.
And the importance of sign, you know, tracks and droppings.
Yeah.
That's critical before you even start looking, isn't it?
It is the absolute first step. You have to be looking for fresh tracks, fresh droppings. If you're walking through what looks like a perfect spot, but there's no fresh sign, the deer are gone.
They've moved on.
They've either been pushed out or they've just shifted their range. The document was really clear on this. Searching a cold zone is the fastest way to just kill your motivation. You have to confirm they are using that area right now.
That makes total sense. Okay, let's move from the basics to some of the more advanced tactic that people use to try and nudge those antlers free. You mentioned they get loose, like a loose tooth.
That's the core of it, yeah. The bone attachment weakens, the antler gets unstable. So if you're trying to get a loose tooth to fall out, you're looking for a way to create some sudden movement, right?
Yeah.
Or impact. Same idea for the deer.
So where are they doing that? Where are they exerting themselves or stopping suddenly?
You have to start paying really close attention to topography and any obstacles in their way. The key spots are where they face a physical demand that jolts the skull.
Like what?
For example, look at deer trails that go steeply uphill. That sudden intense strain on the neck muscles, it causes this moment of serious torque, a jolt.
Okay, uphill trails. What other obstacles should we be checking?
Anywhere they have to jump. That's a big one. It could be a downed log across a trail, or even better, a fence line.
A fence.
Yeah, think about it. When a buck jumps a fence, its head snaps up and then down. It creates this rotational force. They often drop an antler right on the landing side of that jump. The advice is to stop, look at the obstacle, and just methodically search the ground all around it.
It's super tactical. You're looking for those moments of effort. But here's where it gets really interesting, because the material points to this modern trend that combines the need for food with that jolt, the concentrated feeding strategy.
Oh, yeah. This is a favorite for hunters who want to collect sheds in bulk. It's all about setting out feeders or even just big piles of feed in a very concentrated spot.
And what happens when you create this tiny little feeding zone when food is incredibly scarce?
You get intense competition. When you have multiple bucks, especially mature ones, coming to that one food source, they get possessive. And that leads to a lot of physical jostling, head shaking, sometimes even outright sparring for a spot at the dinner table.
And that physical contact, that jolt, that becomes the trigger for shedding.
Absolutely. That contact creates the exact force needed to knock those already loose antlers right off. And the amazing thing about this is that finding sheds there can sometimes be, and I quote, as easy as bending over to pick them up.
Wow.
Because you'll often find multiple antlers that have dropped within just a few feet of the feeder.
And if you're trying to gather intel for next season, this gives you a double payoff.
It really does. Not only do you find the bone, but if you put up a trail camera, you can capture the whole thing. You get video confirmation of the exact bucks that survived the season, what they look like now, and the precise date they dropped their rack. It's high-level intelligence.
So we've got the basics. Food, cover, sign. We have the tactical spots, uphill trails, jumps, feeders. And with all this theory, the author was still wildly unsuccessful.
Right.
Which brings us right to the counterintuitive secret, the big philosophical pivot that came from their very successful hunting partner.
Yes. This partner who finds huge sheds all the time told the frustrated author to basically forget everything they'd read. Just forget it.
Forget it all.
He told them to stop focusing so much on the search itself and start focusing on the journey.
And he used this brilliant analogy to explain why that kind of hyper-focused search is, well, it's doomed to fail. The haystack analogy, that one really stuck with me.
It's such a powerful visual. He said, a needle in a haystack is way easier to find than one shed antler in the middle of the woods. At least you know the needle is in the haystack.
Huh.
Think about that. In the woods, you don't even know if the shed is there to begin with. The odds are just impossibly stacked against you when you're only looking for that one little thing.
You're spending all this mental energy looking for something that might not even be in that spot, and that just leads to frustration and burnout.
Exactly. And that pressure to find the object makes you rush. It makes you miss all the other subtle signs. When you're obsessed with finding a piece of bone, you stop seeing the rest of the forest.
So what was the alternative then? What was the true mission this mentor recommended instead of the frantic search?
The advice was incredibly simple, but really profound. He said, just put your boots on and take a walk. A very long walk.
A long walk.
And the goals of that walk are totally reframed. The objectives become, one, gain a deeper appreciation for Mother Nature, two, enjoy the day away from the office, and three, most importantly, become a much better hunter.
Okay, so if we connect that to the bigger picture of intelligence gathering.
Yeah.
The goal shifts from find the bone to improve the skills you need to find the deer. You're using your downtime for deep learning.
Precisely. The outcome is no longer judged by, you know, the weight of the antler you bring home. The reward is the learning, the knowledge you gain during the process itself. You're using the perfect scouting. Time woods are open, sign is fresh, pressure is low to map the movements of the entire herd.
So after hearing this, the author commits to a new mindset. They don't just throw out all the tactics we talked about, but they remove that pressure of the immediate find.
That adjustment and expectation, that's the whole key. They said they'll still absolutely use the practical tactics. They'll check bedding areas, glass fields, look around jumps. But the core motivation is no longer desperation.
Right.
It becomes an integrated scouting mission that's just disguised as a long walk.
Which brings us to the strategic payoff of this new approach. And this is why it's so valuable to you, the listener, who wants to learn more about your own hunting area. What does this integrated scouting actually accomplish?
It basically becomes a masterclass in topography and animal behavior that you just can't get any other time of year.
Why is that?
Because the leaves are off, the undergrowth is low. The goal is to walk and walk until you really, truly understand how the deer use the land to move so stealthily. You start to see the hidden travel corridors, the pinch points, the funnels you never even noticed when everything was green and thick.
You're building a mental map of their security routes.
Exactly that. They're taking pictures, making notes, mapping out terrain. They're asking, why is the deer sign so heavy on this ridge but totally gone 50 yards over on that one?
Mm.
And they find out the deer are using a shallow ditch or a subtle change in elevation for cover, letting them move completely unseen.
And that kind of deep knowledge has huge benefits for next season.
Oh, it's intelligence that directly changes your outcomes. Through this, you'll inevitably discover a new high-traffic path you never knew existed. You'll find a bedding area you overlooked.
There.
And that lets you move a stand site, maybe just 30 yards, or completely change your whole setup to overlook a new funnel. It vastly improves your advantage for next season.
So success is no longer measured by how many sheds you find, but by how much high-level intel you gather. Although I have to admit, the author did conclude that finding one would sure be nice.
And that's the beauty of it. The finds become a bonus. They're a confirmation of your learning process, not the single frustrating goal.
It's a perfect blend of theory and philosophy, then. Use the specific tactical knowledge to up your chances. But if you don't find the bone, use that same time to fundamentally improve your understanding of the land. It shifts the whole thing from a treasure hunt to essential prep work.
The central lesson here is really profound, I think.
Yeah.
While yes, scouting for food and cover and jolt points is helpful, the most sage advice shifts the focus from the outcome, finding the shed, to the process, learning the land, becoming an expert observer.
That's a massive pivot in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it applies so far beyond just hunting, which it raises an important question, doesn't it? If the best way to find a highly specific rare object is to stop actively looking for it and instead focus all your energy on becoming a better, more observant practitioner, how can applying that same shift process over immediate reward help you tackle other difficult challenges in your life?
I mean, think about it. Tackling a massive report for work or mastering a new complex skill. Sometimes the solution isn't found by just staring harder at the problem right in front of you. It's about widening your scope, taking that long walk through the fundamental concepts, and really getting a feel for the overall terrain. The reward isn't the immediate answer, but the profound skill you've built along the way.
A better, longer, more patient walk instead of a frantic, pressurized search. That is a lesson that will pay off anywhere. Thank you for guiding us through this deep dive.
My pleasure.
So go ahead and apply that strategy of patient, observant learning to whatever you're facing next. Become a better practitioner, and the rewards will follow. And as the wise advice in our source material says, stay safe out there and hunt on. We'll see you on the next deep dive.